2-minute meditation starts now. God,
alright, so we're on, we're moving right along to step 5. If you can turn to page 72. Having made our personal inventory, what shall we do about it? We've been trying to get a new attitude and a new relationship with our Creator and to discover the obstacles in our path. So there, they tell you what the intent behind the fifth step is, a new attitude and a new relationship with our Creator. If you skip down to the next paragraph, this is perhaps difficult, especially discussing our defects with another person. We think we have done well enough in admitting these things to ourselves. There is doubt about that. In actual practice, we usually find a solitary self-appraisal insufficient. Many of us thought it was necessary to go much further. We will be more reconciled to discussing ourselves with another person when we see good reason why we should do so. The best reason first is if we skip this vital step, this life-giving step, life-sustaining step, we may not overcome drinking and or using. Time after time, newcomers have tried to keep to themselves certain facts about their lives, trying to avoid this humbling experience. They have turned to easier methods. Almost invariably, they got drunk or high. Having persevered with the rest of the program, they wondered why they fell. We think the reason is that they never completed their house cleaning. They took inventory all right, but hung on to some of the worst items in stock. They only thought they had lost their egoism and fear. They only thought they had humbled themselves, but they had not learned enough of humility, fearlessness, and honesty in the sense we find it necessary until they told someone else all their life story. More than most people, alcoholics and addicts lead quadruple lives or extra. I don't know why they say double lives, because that's not true. It's like, I don't know what 8 or 9, how you would say it, but like that's the kind. Hexatuplet or something like that.
Octuplet lives.
Octuplet. There's one we know. We lead octuplet lives. He is very much the actor to the outer world. We present our stage characters. These are the ones we like our fellows to see. We want to enjoy a certain reputation, but we know in our hearts they're not deserved. The inconsistency is made worse by the things he does in his sprees, or I do in my sprees. Coming to my senses, I am revolted at certain episodes I vaguely remember. These memories are a nightmare. I tremble to think someone might have observed me. As fast as I can, I push these memories far inside myself. I hope they will never see the light of day. I'm under constant fear and tension and guilt and shame, and that makes for more drug use and drinking. So I believe that the greatest obstacle, one of the great obstacles to a fearless and thorough fifth step is fear. Fear of being found out. Fear of being vulnerable. So this was written by a woman named Marianne Williamson. Our deepest fear is that we are inadequate. Our deepest fear is that we are powerful beyond measure. It is our light, not our darkness, that most frightens us. We ask ourselves, who am I to be brilliant, gorgeous, talented, fabulous? Actually, who are you not to be? You're a child of the universe, a powerful, loving creator. Your playing small does not serve the world. There is nothing enlightened about shrinking so that other people won't feel insecure around you. We are all meant to shine as children do. We were born to make manifest the glory of God that is within us. It's not just in some of us, it's in every single person sitting in this room. And as we let our own light shine, we unconsciously give other people permission to do the same. As we are liberated from our own fear, our presence automatically liberates others. And so, you know, as I think back over the first fifth step, you know, my first step experience was a very powerful spiritual experience for me. I can't say the same about steps 2, 3, 4, but when I completed my first fifth step, that was another spiritual experience, because up until that time, I'd never been completely honest with another human being. So the confessional aspect of my fifth step was extraordinary. I can visualize walking from the front door of my sponsor's house to my car. And I remember reciting to myself, that was the first time I ever was completely honest with another human being. And so that was a turning point for me. Since then, I have done probably over 30 fifth steps. People have heard my inventory. One year, I read to 5 people. Last year, I read to the group that worked the steps together. Sometimes, I've only done it once since my first year. I only read to 1 person. Well, you're asking yourself, where's that in the big book? Let's go to the bottom of page 73. It says, we must be entirely honest with somebody if we expect to live long and happily in this world. Rightly and naturally, we think well before we choose the person or persons with whom to take this intimate and confidential step. So the big book just approved the practice of multiple fifth steps. Brandon hopefully will remember to tell you, like, he's got an interesting take on what happens sometimes as he reads multiple fifth steps and the progression of that process. For me, it's I'm revealing more of myself, so I'm becoming more vulnerable, which I think is a key to the spiritual path, is sharing the vulnerability with others and the deepening the bond. Because I have friendships that have been born out of fifth steps because I've been doing this for so long, and that those are anchors. You know, the more of those experiences you can have, the more anchors you have that keep you here. And so I read this Marianne Williamson because the light will shine after the first fifth step. But I'm convinced that a lot of people hold on to the dark crannies. And the only way I went to Randy's house every Sunday for, I can't remember how many, but a minimum of like 5 or 6. And I think it was more. And he would listen to me for 3 hours. And I had to read every page on my inventory. And I had a 1-inch binder that was almost 1 inch high. And I had all of the behaviors, you know, the homosexual behavior, the stuff with all the prostitutes from hanging out at crack houses and trap hotels and living in places like that. You do a lot of goofy stuff. It just happens, man. Anyone who's lived that life knows what I'm talking about. And so there was a lot of stuff on there that I was afraid to share with another man, right? Because up until that point, nobody knew about those experiences except the people that were involved and myself. And the first like 3 or 4 Sundays, we didn't get that far in the binder. And so the first three or four Sundays, I'm wondering to myself, you know, he's sitting over here on his ottoman in his chair. I'm sitting on the other end of the sofa. I could easily turn three or four pages at the same time, and he won't know if I read it or not. When the time came, I read it all. And what had happened, though, was, well, this was the part that was so phenomenal for me, is he started laughing. And he started telling me stories identical to what I had done. And all these years, I thought that you had to be really messed up to do the things that I had done. And then he sat there and told me, I've done every single one of them. And he told me some stories. And like the healing that happened just from me not being isolated anymore on my little island, thinking I'm the one, I'm over here doing these things that I will keep, take them to my grave. And so there, that was the fear was overcome and the light shined in. And that was a really important turning point for me on this spiritual path. And I've had several instances similar to that, not to that great degree in expansion, like expanding me to where I could, you know, the overwhelming sense of presence that took place. And you got to ask yourself, you know, if you've been doing this thing for a while, how many of those dark crannies were you holding on to? And so I'm not meaning just dark crannies out of the fifth step. We start to gain some dark crannies as we walk the spiritual path. If you get sober and you stay sober for a while, you might accumulate two or three dark crannies along the way. And then the question is, who are you? Is it still a solitary self-appraisal when it comes to those now, since you're in the program and you're working a program and you're on a spiritual path that you don't have to share those dark crannies? So one of the ways I deal with this when I listen to a fifth step. So there's doing a fifth step, which I just described, and there's listening to a fifth step. So when I listen to a fifth step, I want to be engaged. And the way I do that is I keep lists. So I'm working on the eighth step list for the sponsee. I'm working on their sixth step list for character defects. And then I am I'm more engaged if I do that. And then at the very beginning, I ask these questions. I'm going to see if I can remember them all. Have you ever had a homosexual experience? Have you ever been molested or molested? Have you ever been involved in rape, murder, abortion, aggravated assault, and bestiality? I think those are all the questions.
Theft.
And theft. You know, last year I was sponsoring this gentleman, and he came to my house for the fifth step. And I asked him those questions, and we ended up talking for several hours about those questions, and the majority of them had not shown up on his inventory. For whatever reason, they were not under resentments, fears, or conduct. And so a lot of conversation happened around those. And so that's just a little tool I picked up years ago from a guy named Joe Hawk. And I just have used it ever since. So if you want to cut to it, that's how you do it. Yeah, it's... Have you been involved in a homosexual experience, molested on either end, rape on either end, murder, covering up a murder, I think I left that one out, aggravated assault, burglary, theft, burglary, same thing, theft, and bestiality. So,
abortion.
An abortion. So there's a responsibility that's a little bit, it's quite different when you're actually listening to the fifth step. It is an honor to listen to fifth steps. It's also quite pathetic sometimes. It's really difficult for me to listen because some people are so disconnected from responsibility and have a very difficult time taking responsibility. They want to play the victim, and I struggle through those fifth steps. So I'm just throwing that out there because that's something I experience. But the big book's very clear on our exercises. We pocket our pride and go to it, illuminating every twist of character, every dark cranny of the past. That list of questions was dark crannies of the past. Once we've taken this vital step with holding nothing, we are delighted we can look the world in the eye. We can be alone at perfect peace and ease. Our fears fall from us. We begin to feel the nearness of our Creator. We may have had certain spiritual beliefs, but now we begin to have a spiritual experience. The feeling that the drink or the drug problem has disappeared will often come strongly. We feel we were on the broad highway walking hand in hand with the Spirit of the universe. I was blessed to have that description fit me when I walked out of Randy's house after my fifth step, because there was so much about my life that I had not shared, and I'd let it all rip. And I told him my entire life story through my resentments, my fears, and my conduct. And so some people, they work the steps 1 through 9 one time, and they stay sober in 10, 11, and 12, and that works for them. Rock on. That's the only morality that we truly have in our fellowship, which is if it works, keep doing it. If it doesn't work, you may want to try something new. For some people, that works. For me, I like the effect produced by going through the steps at least once a year, the first 9 steps. And doing the fifth steps again is just a way to be vulnerable once again. Vulnerability. Vulnerability leads to intimacy. The best definition of intimacy that I've ever heard was communication with the absence of fear. Right? And that, how do we get to that place? By being transparent. So, yeah. Your turn.
Openness. Nothing is meant to be. There is no predestination. In the ancient text, the idea of predestination is very strong. But the usage of the term is purely metaphorical. People in the past used the word to express feeling of affinity for a place, a time, or for others. But nothing of the future is set. There is no cosmic puppeteer at work. We are solely responsible for our own actions. It is true that we become mired in circumstance so strong and so far-reaching that they will continue to have ramifications far into the future. For example, if we construct circumstances right, such as starting an organization to help others, then the good will last for a long time. However, if we fall far into debt and do nothing to help ourselves, then the bad will also last a long time. Yet in both cases, our lasting situations are results of our own actions. This is not destiny, it is causality. Causality is from the past, and nothing is acting from the future. There is no script, no pattern to walk into. Everything has to be created, and we are the artist. Those who follow Spirit endeavor to have as few restrictions placed upon them as possible. By completing each action, they minimize causality. By living fully in the present, they absorb the best of what each day has to offer. By understanding that there is no literal destiny, fate, or predestination, they keep the future as free and as open as possible. That is truly the openness of life. You see, before I actually did a fifth step, I was stuck in all of this stuff. So my destiny was set to be miserable and go through this miserable existence with all the carrying all this miserable stuff behind me. But once I did this fifth step and I saw the truth of how I really was and how I really acted, and I really saw that I was absolutely the cause of all my misery, the freedom started. It started to open up. And just like anything, there's layers upon layers upon layers. As you dig deeper into the strata of your life, you start to see the different things. And so the first inventory I wrote, when I shared it in the fifth step, I saw a lot of the connection from my sex conduct and how it filtered through my life. And about 2 years sober, the resentments gave me a lot of information that exposed my character to me. At about 3.5 years sober, I wrote a fear inventory that crushed me and changed me to the point where Like when I was writing it, I was just disgusted at the way that I showed up so different than how I thought I was. I remember when I was writing it, we had a workshop out at the monastery, and I called Tarek from the snack bar there, and I was starting to write my fear inventory, and I had only written like the first one and started the second one, and I was just so absolutely disgusted at how dominated I was by fear and how I was showing up so differently that I called Tarek and I said, I need your help. I can't write this fear inventory. And he said, so why are you calling me? I was like, well, I want you to say some magic shit that's going to get me to go back there and keep writing. And so he goes, okay, hold on. I have to think of something. And then he said, so why do we write inventory? I said, to better our relationship with God and remove the things that are blocking us from God. And he said, okay, I'm in construction. So he pulled a construction analogy out. He said, if you ever watch an excavator, it's a destructive process as the excavator's digging through the layers of the earth and exposing the bedrock. But if you never get down to that bedrock, that foundation, you'll never be able to have a firm foundation going forward. And so then he paused and he said, how did I do? I was like, that's good. I'll go back. And I wrote a very profound fourth step or fear inventory around that. And then I shared that with multiple people. Usually I have a black notebook that's got a bunch of pieces of inventory in it that I usually share some pieces when we do a workshop. I just got a different car, and for some reason that didn't make it into the new car. It's sitting on my desk at the house. And so, but the thing that I find is as I read inventory and pieces of inventory, the more people I read it to, really the more insane it sounds. Now, when I'm writing that piece of inventory, like, it seems like it's so monumental and earth-shattering that, like, I don't want to keep writing it. But the minute that I start sharing it, there's something magical that happens. So, you know, maybe Elliot's the first guy I read it to, and I'm reading it to him, and I show up this a certain way when I read the inventory, and I emphasize certain words differently. And I realize the things that maybe he responds to in a certain way, and it's like, okay. So then when I start reading to Jay, the second person I'm reading to, I'm trying to remember the things that Elliot really attached to, and so I can emphasize those to Jay. I might get some of them, but Jay's going to have a different set of ideas that he hooks onto and agrees with me in a different way. So that by the time I start reading it to Tarek, I forget what those guys thought was important or wasn't important. That probably Tarek gets the more honest out of the three inventories. And then the guy that I read to after that, I expose who I am more and more. And I remember there was a piece of inventory that I had written, and I think it was the fifth person I read it to. Same piece of inventory. And when I read inventory, I read what I wrote. I don't add to it, take away, whatever. I read what I wrote. And I read it, and I finished this little section, and he's like, man, you are one entitled motherfucker. And it shocked me. I was like, what? And then I went back and looked at the notes of the four people prior that I had read that same piece of inventory to, and not one of them had said that I was entitled. But the fifth guy heard it. And so then when I really started going back and analyzing, what I realized is he was absolutely right. I thought these people owed me some stuff. And so that exposed a character within me that says that you owe me things. I also, by the way, God shows up that way for me too, is that I think because I do workshops and I sponsor people that God owes me some shit, right? Pretty entitled, right? Not that I earned it. I'm owed it. So I put the same limitations on God that I put on other people, and this comes out in inventory. And when I start to see that, my relationship with God changes. My relationship with other people changes. And Guys, there has not been a single piece of inventory that has been read to me where I didn't find something in their story that actually applied directly to me. I mean, Bill talked about it last night when he shared his story. Bill's a 30-some-year-old heterosexual male, and he's got a 60-year-old homosexual male that's reading inventory to him, and other than the people's names, the same shit shows up. I've had so many other sponsees that they will say constantly when they're working the first four steps with the guy, it's like, I still haven't figured out why this guy asked me to be a sponsor. He listens to that fifth step and he's like, I know why I'm this guy's sponsor. There are so many times I leave a fifth step that I've been listening to where that guy's got some relief that he's walked out of, and I'm driving home thinking, man, I got some work to do. Okay. People seem to like the chicken story, so I'll share this one. A lot of the time I have guys come out to the farm and read inventory at the farm. I like to usually have a fire to burn off some of that negative juju that's there. Animals are usually free ranging around us, and we're outside in the open air where I'm not trapped with the negative energy that they have. We can talk more about that if you want to on the side, but it's the actual expelling of energy, I know, is a absolutely 100% real thing. And here's how I know. I can't think of a piece of inventory where a guy hasn't been reading inventory out at the farm in the same place where he has this huge revelation in his life. And I just say, hey, look, you notice the chickens? They're all right around his chair. They're just hanging out. And he's like, how long they been here? I was like, they walked over when you were reading that piece. They experienced something that they're unaware of. They're still scratching and clawing and eating bugs and doing whatever. But it's like his spirit needed to borrow some energy from somewhere, and these things show up. You want to get out there in the metaphysical realm, start watching things in the world. You'll experience some of the craziest shit that probably, as I say them to you, you think, yeah, whatever, that's not real. Come watch. So you think there's a spiritual release? You think there's some healing that happens in the fifth step? I've seen it. You can be sitting across from a guy that's reading you a piece of inventory, and you're looking down, taking notes, and you look up, and literally, there is a different-looking person sitting across from you. His energy has shifted. There's been a release. There's been this weight that's been taken off of him where he looks 10 years younger sometimes just because of that stuff that he's been carrying around. The major difference between listening to an inventory, it's so funny because I've listened to so many alcoholics and so many addicts' inventories that there's hardly a single addict that hasn't read a piece of inventory where they didn't want to expose that crazy shit that happened when they were in the trap house, the homosexual stuff that they were going to take to their grave, that it's in just about every addict's inventory. Just about everyone. And the alcoholics, the dishonesty that is just riddled in their stuff, and they seem to like strippers too and do some crazy stuff there and some dishonesty. But it's like, guys, like, the only thing that has been read to me in inventory that has not shown up on at least one other is there was a guy that when he was 8 years old, he heard his dad and his uncle plotting his mom's murder. It's the only piece. It's the only thing in 8 years and probably 100 fifth steps that I've listened to that hasn't been repeated. Everything else has. You're not that special. Your experience is not that different from anybody else's. You think it is because it's your experience, but it's not. It's the same, just changed.
Like, you hear a lot of people talk about the fifth steps, and like you were saying, that you see this change and this great experience, you know, with relief and everything. What if when you've done your fifth step, that isn't what you have? It was opposite for me. I saw how big of a piece of shit I really was. You know.
The spiritual shift happens at different places for different people. I wish that there was a magical thing where I could tell you that a guy does a third step prayer and all of a sudden he's changed and he writes inventory, gets it done, knocks it out, and everything's great from then on. I wish I could tell you that you read a fifth step, it fixes it. I wish I could tell you that after you do the sixth step and you do the seventh step prayer that it shifts. Probably more often what I see is when people start making amends, the shift happens there. That's probably the greatest place of transition that I've seen, because people actually really start to change their behavior when they start to get feedback from the people that they're making amends to. A guy that gets hooked up with meditation early in recovery, like let's say he starts when he first comes in, I mean, I've got a guy like that. He started meditating like right out of the gate. Like, he's already a different person. We didn't even finish step two. Because his energy shifted. So there's no like line where somebody shifts. It happens all over. If you get to 12 and it hasn't happened, you're probably fucked. But I don't know. There was another one back over there.
Hold on. I want to address him real quick. So, I've had this question or this experience with men I've sponsored, a handful of them over the years, and the conversation I have with them is immediately going to go to, okay, so you came out of your fifth step feeling worse than you did going into it, so you must think you could have done different. So let's talk about that, because with the things that you did in your that you are creating this idea of self-loathing are the actions you took, right? So you could have done different. Well, therefore, I automatically know this guy does not understand the first step. Because the first step says you're powerless, that you couldn't have done any different. Otherwise, you would have done different. So then what I do is I turn the conversation to, okay, so this is about power now and accessing conscious contact as often as possible. What are you willing to do to never be the man that did those actions? That's what happened to me. So it became unacceptable to be a guy that could be called a piece of shit, because I was called a piece of shit quite often before I got clean and sober. And so if you have that going on, I would suggest going back to the first step, because there's an implication to me that I'm seeing someone who thinks they could have done different. If you think you could have done different, then you truly do not. You have not experienced the first step. You just have some understanding of the mechanics of the first step. Does that make sense?
Yeah.
Hold
on. Somebody over there.
There's two others back there, then Kellen.
I just want to ask, so you said, you know, like when you're talking about putting limitations on yourself and putting limitations on God, would you say that doing the fifth step is not only recognizing where you put limitations on others, but what, you know, in doing the fifth step, you see where your limitations are put, where you let others and yourself put limitations in your life and on God? Like, do you think that's one of the things that would help you understand where your limitations are or where you accept your limitations? I mean, you get what I'm saying? Like,
yes.
Your limitations.
Yes, I get you, and yes, I agree. It's all that, right?
I mean, that.
What inventory does is it exposes the real me to me.
Yeah.
Simply put, it's no longer the idea of me, it is me. It's in black and white, it's right there written in front of me.
I mean, could you, your question, are you trying to figure something out through the inventory? Are you trying to gain a better understanding of yourself? I'm just curious of that, what your intent as you walk in the inventory is.
Well, I'm wondering if I can actually be without limitations, if I can be so open-minded that there is no limitations.
No.
And I didn't want to put that out there.
It's impossible. That's what makes us human. Our limitations is one of the things. We will always be limited. Even if we live a way of life that's trying to free us so we are limitless. I will always brush up into some limit that's part of my character. And it'll show. It can show up in judgment. It can show up in my actions. It can show up in my relationships. The struggle. You know, we are constantly experiencing, at least me. Maybe it's just me. Who knows? But I, on a regular basis, have an area in my life where I'm experiencing what I call burning or friction. That's because I'm rubbing up against one of my limits. It's okay. Can I grow past that limit? Yes, maybe. Maybe not. Maybe it's so deeply ingrained in me that it's going to be with me, and the only thing that's going to change is my awareness of it as I practice this longer and longer. So its presence sort of thins out, and it's not as thick. But the idea that I will be some being drifting and hanging out in the position of neutrality without any limitations, never being bothered by anything, is not something I aspire to, nor do I think is possible.
Oh, okay, I'm sorry. You're right. What I'm really saying is the awareness of it, is that the awareness of your limitations is the ability to solve that limitation, to move past. There will always be limitations, but there's always a solution to a limitation.
Maybe.
I was just trying
to... No, I mean, it's a good question, but it's... We're getting outside of... more of an 11th step conversation than a fifth step. No, it's fine. It's a good question. There was one more over there. Wasn't there? Maybe not. Kellen?
So when Brian was, you know, asking about that afterwards, and you were saying, you know, you didn't have a choice and stuff, what about the resentments and the mistakes that you made in recovery?
I read that piece about being driven. Driven by 100 forms of fear, self-delusion, self-seeking, and self-pity. Those happen in recovery too. Just because we work the step doesn't mean we no longer can be driven. So a lot of the times when I hurt people, it's because I'm unconscious and I am driven. And all I see is the manifestation of what I believe my self-will should manifest in this situation. I'm over-identified with the situation. So therefore, I have tunnel vision with the situation. And typically, when I have tunnel vision, I hurt people. I step on their toes. All right? Same concept. It just doesn't involve drugs and alcohol. There, we are compelled and moved. The force moving us is the relationship with the drugs and the alcohol, too. Does that make sense?
Yeah.
Okay.
So we do this thing, inventory, and if we've got a good sponsor, how are you going to say that? We have this list of defects that's generated out of the fifth step. Self-defeating principles, defects. Not good enough. I need to always be right. People should do as I do, or do as I say, not as I do, right? I want to be treated special. All these things that show up, I'm just throwing out some of mine. I'm important, and I'm going to prove it to you. These are the things that show up, right? So, as we finish... the fifth step, there's the part of the fifth step that's right before the sixth step that I just have to assume that people don't know is in our book, because I've never been in a meeting where anybody spends any time talking about this, unless it's a meeting that maybe Tarek and I are in. At the bottom of page 75, it says, returning home, we find a place where we can be quiet for an hour. Carefully reviewing what we have done, we thank God from the bottom of our heart that we know Him better. Taking this book down from the shelf, I'm a literalist, I put it up on the shelf and pull it down from the shelf. We turn to the page which contains the 12 steps, which would be page 59. Carefully reviewing the first 5 proposals, we ask if we have omitted anything, for we are building an arch through which we shall walk a free man at last. Is our work solid so far? Are stones properly in place? Have we skimped on the cement put into the foundation? Have we tried to make mortar without sand? Now, notice it says returning home. It doesn't say like 2 weeks later. So this is very important for people to kind of seal up the fourth and fifth step process, to where if we finished it and if I'm sponsoring you, I've given you the self-defeating principles and character defects, And on the right side of the page is the name list of the names of all the people that I think that you've harmed and you probably owe an amends to. I give that to you and I review it with you and I say, is this accurate? Does this sound like you? If it doesn't, let's talk about it. What do you not understand that I wrote down? And then I send them home and I tell them to do this exercise. If it's late at night, I say, do it in the morning. But I would recommend that you do it if you can when you get home. And then usually what happens is as the guy sits there in an hour, he has some experience. Maybe it's negative. Maybe he doesn't want to be the way that he's been. Maybe he's like, holy shit, I finally got all this stuff out. And the guy wasn't disgusted by me. Maybe he's just like, holy crap, I can actually breathe for the first time in my life. Or possibly he's like, you know, there were a couple things that I just forgot to bring up. And so the instructions I give them is to, you know, call me the next day. And they call. And probably about half of the time, there's some little thing that they left out that's like, oh, yeah, you know, I forgot about this experience, this, that, or the other. And it's like, okay, thank you for sharing that. Is there anything else? No. Okay, good. It doesn't mean that if he forgot something that he can't bring it up later. It's just like we want to go into the sixth step with this full knowledge that I've got it all out. Cut out the infection. Now it's time for healing to start. Okay? So then on page 76, we've got two steps and two paragraphs. Right? And they're phenomenal the way that I think that they're written. Page 76, it says, if we can answer to our satisfaction those questions that were on the bottom of page 75, then we look at step 6. We have emphasized willingness as being indispensable. Are we now ready to let God remove from us all the things which we have admitted are objectionable? Now, there's one sentence there with one question mark, but there's two questions in that sentence. If I've done the thorough inventory to this point, I've gone through 4 and I've gone through 5 and I've reviewed that with my sponsor or somebody else, then I've got this list of the way that I interact with the world. Like, is it okay for me to continue to act that way with the world? That's the first question. Is it objectionable? Is it okay for me to continue to wreck every relationship showing up this way? If the answer is yes, it's okay, then no need to change. Keep getting the results you're getting. I've not had too many people say, I want to keep being the way that my life has been. So then there's the other question, which is, are you now ready to let God remove these things? Okay. Now, it doesn't say that God's going to remove them. It says, are you now willing to have God remove them? And so some of those things may not, you might not entirely want to get rid of. Like maybe I want to stop hurting people, but I really kind of like being the smart ass. Okay? Well, that's okay. The focus is that you want to stop hurting people, right? So if we take this to God then, I usually have guys sit on the sixth step to have an experience. Until something happens. Maybe it's a shift in consciousness. Maybe they find themselves completely acting out in one of their defects in a way that is completely unacceptable to them. And they have this complete breakdown. Maybe they're overcome by emotion, positive or negative. And then when that happens, usually within the first week or two, then I tell the guy that, okay, now it's time to go on with the prayer. Now, the way that this showed up for me the first time I went through inventory was very profound. It had been about a week, maybe 2 weeks. My sponsor had me resting on this step. And I had, that morning I had set the intention that I was going to meditate on the mother of my children. And she was going to be focused on the meditation just to see what came back. And so I sat there with the intent of her, putting it out here in front of my mind. My thoughts come in from this direction. Yours come in from wherever they come in from, and that's great. That's correct. But mine come in from over here. So my thoughts come in from the right side of my head, and this other thought of this experience when I was a child kept kind of smashing its way into my mind, and I kept pushing it back out, like, no. Like, I know what I'm doing. I'm focusing on this. You stay over there. But this thought kept coming in. So finally, I gave up and quit fighting, and this thought came in. It was this experience as a child that was in my inventory, but I thought it was rather insignificant. It was just something, you know, some kids doing whatever. But what happened is it came in, and then I saw all these defects that I had, like this desire to be right, this desire to impress women, this desire to dominate relationships, this desire to prove I was important, all this stuff. These defects are kind of floating around out here, and there's the experience in the middle, and then in a flash, they all somehow connected, and I saw that the basis of who I was out of this one experience completely transformed the way that I experienced life. And I'm sitting there having one of those weepy cry, like overcome by emotion things. But it was so strange because I was completely blind to the experience that I was sharing it with my sponsor that night. And he's like, so what's that six-step experience going to look like for you? And I was like, I don't know, but I'm looking forward to it. And he's like, tell me the story again. So I told him the story again. He's like, is it possible that was it? But out of that experience, what happened is that I was visited by a something, spirit, whatever. And I saw that there was no need to continue to live life the way that I was. So for me, in my first inventory, the relief didn't come after inventory. But this six-step experience was so profound and life-transforming that I felt like a new person right after this meditation. I wish I could tell you that every meditation from there on was that way. I've had some pretty cool experiences, but like this was pretty profound. And so then I was willing to go to the prayer. Okay. Now, am I pausing or am I going to keep going for a minute? Sounds like I'm keeping going. Okay. So the prayer is just the third step prayer, and I'll close, right? It says, my creator, I'm now willing that you should have all of me, good and bad. I pray now that you remove from me every single defect of character which stands in my way of my usefulness to you and my fellows. Grant me strength as I go out from here to do your bidding. Amen. Now, interesting thing, interesting to me, maybe you don't care. Seventh step prayer closes with amen. If you go back to page 63, the third step prayer did not. So I like to theorize, and this is the way I think, so I believe this is the case, that everything that you do between 3 and 7 is one continuous prayer. And that you ask God in the third step prayer to show you how to change. You, through your own handwriting and listening, get to see how you need to change. And you get to 7 and you're like, okay, cool, I'm ready for it. Now, I wish... that it was just as awesome and powerful as like these defects just go away and then we can all just march our way through the rest of our life and happy and rainbows and butterflies and all that fun stuff. Koala bears, if that's what you're into. But as I've been here, what the realization that I have had is that the defect has an equal asset, exactly equal. So I have a defect where I like to be the center of attention and have people listen to me. When I'm in a group of people, there are a bunch of chiefs, like when we went to the Braves game the other day, where I was with a bunch of alphas, everybody wanting to direct us where to go, that would have been a defect. Today, as I sit here in front of all of you, and I'm comfortable being me and being the center of attention, it's an asset. Same trait. Two physical ones to throw at you. I started shaving every day in eighth grade. For the better part of my life, it was a pain in the ass to have to shave every day. About 7 years ago, I decided to start growing a beard. Great trait. Grow a kick-ass beard, right? When I start hitting the gym, I gain mass, physical mass, very quickly. Clearly, I have not been to the gym in a while, so I gain a different kind of weight in a different, equally quick manner. Same trait. So the way my body processes things. Okay? So if you really start to look at these things, I had a conversation with a guy the other day. He's married to a good solid Al-Anon. I'm in a relationship with an Al-Anon. I'm going to steal a Joe Hawk joke here. Is I love being in a relationship with an Al-Anon because we both love the same person. And so my buddy's in a relationship with an Al-Anon, and she is trying to fix some of her friends, and one of her friends is coming in town and is going to stay with them because his mom is really mean to him, but yet my buddy's going out of town, and his wife is allowing this friend to stay in his house without them being there, and he's not cool with it. And he's like complaining about this trait of how she wants to fix and help everybody. And I'm like, well, you really like that trait when it works to your advantage and she's willing to help you out and take care of you. Well, yeah. Okay, same trait. We all have them. We all have these things that the other side of the coin that is the exact same thing. So I wish I could tell you that your defects are going to disappear when you do the seven-step prayer. Now, what happens, a little foreshadowing, is that your defects soften. For me, it softened a lot when I started knocking on enough doors, making amends, apologizing, or trying to make right the fact that I was an asshole. And probably after 2 or 3 or 10 of those, I started to realize, maybe I'm just an asshole. And the question then becomes, does that bother me? And if it's starting to harm people, yes, it does, and I want to change. Now, I also like to prod people and poke people. And it's working with you guys. It irritates my children sometimes that I poke and prod them. And I've been accused of bullying them sometimes because I like to play with them. But I'm doing it with you guys, and I'm challenging you to look at things different ways. And I'm pissing some of you off. I see it. But God's using that trait to get you to do something different. Using my defect to change you for the better. Pretty cool, isn't it?
He covered that so masterfully. So the miracles of Steps 6 and 7 happen in the actions of steps 8 and 9. And he alluded to that. But they still don't get cast out. They still don't get removed. A guy that I respect, I heard him describe his defects. He'd been sober. He's sober now 35 years. And I was at a workshop that he put on. He was the facilitator 2 years ago, and he talked about, or it may have been last year, regardless, he talked about the same defects of character he showed up with 35 years ago at the doorstep of Alcoholics Anonymous are the same defects of character that he has with him 35 years later. So at first I was like, huh, that's interesting. But then he added a little metaphor to it. And he described his defects when he first showed up here as two roaring lions that were with him at all times. Now, over the course of that time, now it's like two little baby purring kittens. Right? But this ties into what Bill Wilson, how he describes defects of character in Bill's story. He says, "My newfound friend came to take them away root and branch." What happens to us is a lot of the branches are cast out. The stealing, gone. Rude behavior and disrespecting people to their face and just outlandish behavior, pretty much gone immediately. But what's underneath all of that, right? There are these grosser handicaps. A common grosser handicap that I have is I like to be important. In some situations, it does not serve me. In this situation, sitting up here with you guys, that's motivating and propelling me to present this in an attractive way, hopefully. Another grosser handicap of mine is that what I went through as a child puts me in a position where I deserve. I deserve to be dealt some good cards from time to time. I struggle with that ending up in that dynamic with the universe. I snap out of it quickly, but it's still there. Except way back when, I used it to justify all my behavior. Right? Now it's not a justification for behavior. But the idea still comes up from time to time. A grosser handicap is my time is more important than your time. I struggle with that. I've struggled with that for 12 years. So these are some common grosser handicaps that I have. And the idea that they're just going to be eradicated doesn't work for me. And there's a mercy and a grace wrapped up in my limitations and my character defects, because without them, I wouldn't need God. So they create a poverty in me where it keeps me in a state of needing God. It's like the man who's thirsty and wants to have his thirst quenched. We want to stay thirsty for God. It's better that we never get our thirst quenched. So if everything was just lifted out of us and we didn't struggle anymore, I wouldn't need God anymore. And so my defects, they sit me down at the table with my higher power on a regular basis. They put me in a state of begging sometimes. They put me in the fetal position sometimes. But I've been taught that the anguish and despair and the flipping and the fluctuation of life, of going from happy, joyous, free to angry, despair, anger, depression, anxiety, that's just part of it. And a lot of the times the anxiety and the depression that I'm experiencing is wrapped up in some part of my character and how it's showing up. And so therefore I go deeper into my relationship with God. It seems to propel the increase the sincerity of my prayers, because I see a need. And I think without limitations and defects of character, I wouldn't see the need, because I don't have the drugs and alcohol anymore to see the need. So it has to be left. So the spiritual journey has become one of character refinement over the course of time. Now, there was a time in my recovery, if you came to my home group and you didn't talk about step 12, I tell you to get off your ass and go help somebody. And you were focused on the step that separates the men from the boys, which I truly think everything we do on the spiritual journey, really the linchpin is step 6 and 7. Personally. Now, the reason we have our 12 steps is they culminate into the steps, the traditions, the concept service. They culminate into carrying the message. But when you look at this in a personal evolution and spiritual evolution, it has everything to do with character. So I want to read an article that I stumbled across a couple years ago that sort of encapsulates what I just said, and then we're going to wrap it up. All diseases have the potential to distort one's character, particularly in shrinking one's world to a state of near complete self-absorption. But addiction is unique within the annals of medical disorders in the extremes to which one's unique essence is distorted as the disorder progresses. By radically reordering personal priorities, addiction ultimately sacrifices all other personal commitments and aspirations to serve this higher need. It shrinks one world and hollows one out, leaving only this insatiable need and the painful consequences of serving that need at the center of oneself. Addiction medicine, actually all medicine, is ill-equipped to address such pathologies of character and to fill the void once drugs are removed from the center of an addict's patient's life. The person seeking addiction recovery is left with the same challenge. How does one escape such chemically induced narcissism within a culture that not just worships the self, but has labeled itself the selfie culture? So we talk about, there's a concept of recovery and remission that he talks about. I don't want to read all that, but we're going to, you know, remission. Think of remission as just having the drugs and the alcohol removed, and that's all that's done. In contrast, the term recovery, used more frequently by those who lived experience of having survived addiction, is often used to suggest a process of change far beyond the removal of alcohol and other drugs from an otherwise unchanged life. It depicts the process of moving through and beyond remission to refill oneself, develop depth of character, and propel one towards relationships and contributions that reach beyond the self. In some recovery circles, drunk, lacking emotional sobriety, in some recovery circles, remission without recovery is even castigated as a shallow level of achievement. In such circles, remission is viewed as the temporary suppression of symptoms, where recovery is viewed as the process through which the surviving person is transformed. Remission can be an act of self-assertion, but recovery, this larger achievement of global health and functioning, often comes through an embrace of one's limitations and character defects and transcendence from domination of the personal ego. It involves the acceptance of one's brokenness, the practice of restraint and moderation in our thoughts, feelings, and actions, and finding a purpose for one's own spiritual path. Recovery in this view requires replacing the I language of alienation with the we language of human connection, shedding the selfie culture and embracing a culture of humility, tolerance, interdependence, and community. Awareness of imperfection and limitation and character defects allows us, through becoming strong in the weak places, to use adversities of character to build depth of character. Such depth is about far more than character reconstruction as a monument to self-fulfillment. It is about character in service to the larger needs of humanity. To achieve this shift, researchers suggest the need for redemptive assistance, resources beyond the self, the courage to face one's empty self, and the humility to reach out to others are the first steps in seeing ourselves not as the center of the universe, instead discovering how our small story fits into a much larger story. To recognize our brokenness and to heal in this way turns adversity and suffering into a transcendent purpose or sacred calling. Recognizing our flawed nature and quieting the war of our own ego to the extent that we can actually listen to and experience other people. Extreme narcissism, self will run riot in the language of Alcoholics Anonymous, is the essence of addiction. Regardless of whether one sees this trait as a cause or consequence of addiction, regardless of whether that entrapment in self is manifested in grandiosity and acts of exploitation or in self-hatred and self-harm, it is a paradoxical entrapment that combines self-absorption and self-inflation on the one hand with self-hatred and deteriorating self-care on the other. Escaping these faces of addiction may require the shift from getting deeper into oneself to finally getting out of oneself. That journey from the abyss to the world is what builds character. That journey is the essence of recovery and what distinguishes recovery from remission. We are learning a lot about the prevalence and pathways of remission through advances in addiction research. The processes of recovery have yet to fully arrive as a subject of scientific investigation. Many of our addiction treatments, including an expanding menu of medications, can facilitate remission. Few of those treatments offer hope for the long-term process of character reconstruction to achieve recovery. Men and women seeking the latter must look to other contexts for such support. A friend of mine sent that to me, and it really paralleled where I was on my own spiritual journey and this idea of character refinement and how reckoning myself on a daily basis with how I'm showing up in my life and practicing a degree of conscientiousness. Because we come from a line of people that say our troubles are all of our own making. I know the big book says it, but we truly try to live that way. Another way is calling it the path of blame. And I don't mean blame in a neurotic way where you're always blaming yourself and ruminating over your past mistakes. I'm talking blame in such a way that you have that level of conscientiousness where you are taking a moment on a daily basis and reflecting on your actions with people and having that reckoning and taking responsibility. And so that's part of this sixth and seventh step. But early on, the miracle of 6 and 7 happened in the actions of 8 and 9, because I got to sit across the table and look into someone's eyes and truly see how I hurt people with my character limitations and defects, which gave me a desire to dive deeper in order to have a revolutionary experience with the change of my character, is one way of looking at it. In a lot of ways, I'm very different from the person that existed 12 years ago. But in so many ways, I'm still the same. All right. I think that's a good place to stop. We're going to come back at 6 o'clock after dinner, unless you got something you want to add. Come back at 6 o'clock, and we'll start steps 8 and 9.